Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Johnson, Judge Bjorkman, Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, this fourth day of November 2020. We are conducting our hearings this morning remotely via the Zoom platform, although our rules of procedure remain. Each side will have 15 minutes for their primary oral argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal argument, should he choose to use it. Each attorney should state his name immediately before presenting his argument, so we have that for the record. With that, we are ready to have oral arguments in the first case, State of Minnesota versus Kim Dale Thompson. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Christopher Saylors on behalf of the appellant. Thank you. Mr. Thompson did not receive a fair trial, from the pretrial rulings to the prosecutorial misconduct to the shifting of the burden to the 63420/Spriegel evidence to the sufficiency of the evidence. I want to first discuss the prosecutorial misconduct. This was done on multiple occasions and it was objected to on multiple occasions, so the court needs to consider whether the improper statements likely substantially influenced the jury's verdict. In a case like this that was solely focused on credibility, the difference of credibility in this case was on a razor's edge. So therefore, the misconduct definitely attributed to the jury's verdict in the way that it was. In the prosecutor's own statement, he admitted that, indicating that credibility is key in this case. He was the only person in this trial to call the main witness, RRT, honest. He didn't just call her honest, he referred to her as very honest. The defense had six witnesses that we called out that were primary purpose was to talk about her reputation for truth and honesty. All six of those witnesses.
Wasn't the reference to the honest, I mean, just one reference about a particular fact and evidence, and that was, I think, when she was confined to her room or the sunroom or for some period of time. I mean, that wasn't a statement made about her testimony in general. It had to do with a particular point, correct?
Right, but it speaks to a larger point that if he's calling her honest about this thing, then what is he saying, that she's not honest about other things? So if she's going to be honest in one form of the scenario about the incident with the car, then she's obviously an honest honest person. Again, that was the only reference to her honesty in the whole case. The state called a couple of witnesses from the family. Her husband, he was never asked to offer opinion about her honesty or even offered to rehabilitate her honesty. Another state witness, which was her brother, Kim Paul Thompson, he was called and she couldn't say one way or the other if she was honest. So really the only person to call the state's witness, the main witness in this case, RRT honest, was the prosecutor. He was an officer of the court. This is improper vouching, and he was expressing an opinion of her credibility. In addition to injecting his personal opinion about the most important witness's credibility, he also belittled the defense on multiple occasions. He said it was the defense attorney's job to poke holes in the case. There was an investigation in this case. I detailed it in my brief. I don't need to go into more detail right now about some of the very unique and never done before things were done in this investigation. The prosecutor not only said that it was my job as a paid attorney or a court appointed attorney, but simply that's what I have to do as a defense attorney to defend my client by essentially pointing out that an investigation was bad. So not only did he belittle the defense, but what he did was very impressive as far as prosecutorial misconduct goes, because in the same thought, he not only belittled the defense, but he also shifted the burden. He said probably one of the more problematic things that he suggested in his closing argument, in a closing argument that was littered with problematic things, is that he said that if we have the temerity to say that this was an improper investigation, well, he's called no witnesses up here to show this was an improper investigation. And that is a 100% shifting the burden to indicate that I am unable to make an argument because I'm not a police officer. I'm just a defense attorney who's getting paid to make arguments for my client.
Isn't that a comment on the evidence, though? I mean, it seems like running throughout this case was the suggestion that this investigation was outside of the norm and that it was somehow improper, but yet there was no witness that testified to that. So why isn't that a proper comment on the evidence for the prosecutor to have made?
why would a witness have to, well, first of all, the officers agreed that it was improper, but I guess that's not the point of Your Honor. The point was, that's a shifting the burden that we would have to call an expert to basically say what the police did in this particular situation was completely improper. And quite frankly, that wasn't necessarily the defense. The defense was that they were grasping at straws, and that's what they had to do. They had to resort to these tactics to essentially try to get Wendy Thompson, the mother of RRT, to be able to agree that all this went on underneath her nose in the house. The questioning of Wendy Thompson was, quite frankly, one of the more odd things I've ever seen in 13 years of practicing law. But the prosecutor insinuated that if I had the audacity to call it an improper investigation, I need to call my own witnesses. That is a 100% shifting the burden. We didn't have any witnesses to say that. I think that's a legitimate argument that it can be made, especially with the facts and the evidence. And the prosecutor shifted the burden to indicate, well, here, jury, they don't have that. They can't prove that this was an improper investigation because they didn't call any witnesses. That's just the paid defense attorney shilling out for his client, making this comment. So I thought that was incredibly problematic. It reminded me of what happened in the Tate case about a shifting the burden to make the defense explain why this investigation was so bad. The next thing I want to touch on is the 63420 evidence. The 63420 evidence, quite frankly, was a mess. We had a very long motion in limine hearing about the 63420 evidence. And I said at the time of the motion in limine hearing, this was allegations that would have to be defended like Ness. Ness went back 35 years. This went back 40 years of being a parent. About parental discipline.
Counsel,
I'm sorry.
Judge, yes. Larkin here. You're citing Ness in support of your arguments regarding the 63420 evidence, but isn't Ness a case that deals with Spriegel, and 63420 is different than Spriegel and not governed by the cases or rules that govern Spriegel, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I concede that completely, but I think 63420 and is designed from Spriegel. I think there's a lot of similar characteristics. I'm not saying that they're identical, but the proposition that I'm citing for Ness is that the remoteness of these allegations. Ness spoke to the remoteness of the allegations. Ness went back 35 years, and the allegations that we talked about went back 40 years.
So really, I had said, you're arguing that they're not it's not as probative, and that the prejudicial impact is outweighed because they're so remote.
Absolutely. And there was no finding that was ever made that the judge just said these things can come in. If the court's familiar with the judge's order, just kind of was like, well, these motions are approved 16, 12, 14 without any clarification. When the court made a great effort at the time of the motion eliminated to talk about how we're going to go through and pick out these particular incidents. I'm not just going to paint this with a broad brush, and I'm paraphrasing, but that was the gist of what the court said in response to my argument that he's on trial for criminal sexual conduct. He's not on trial for domestic assault. Society's views on parental discipline have evolved greatly over 40 years. I did not go back and look at the domestic abuse statutes 40 years ago, but I would imagine they're quite a bit different than they are now. And to go back and just allow the state to have carte blanche to be able to say, let's talk about abuse, let's general abuse. How did your father discipline you? How did you do this? Those are not specific incidents of conduct. That's directly talking about abuse at that time. And I think it went well beyond what the judge had intended at the time of the oral argument for the motion in limine, and then what guidance was given in the order. What was further problematic about the 63420 evidence was the lack of the consistency as far as the instructions where it would go limit the impact of the jury. Kim Paul Thompson was RRT was the first person to testify for the state. RRT's testimony, there was no cautionary instruction about the 63420 evidence. The state asked very broad questions about how did your father discipline you, made it a very large focus of the state's case. Kim Paul Thompson was the second state's witness. Kim Paul Thompson testified, and there was no cautionary instruction. And then perhaps the state's most poignant 63420 / Spriegel, because it seems a little unclear how it actually came in, whether it was Spriegel or 63420, was Jocelyn Thompson And then there was a cautionary instruction, and there was quite a bit of lengthy discussion between the bench and myself about how I did not want there to be instruction at this point, because there hadn't been for the other two cases. At that time, it's going to put an undue impact on Jocelyn Thompson's testimony, which I don't know if the jury found anything Jocelyn Thompson said was credible, but that's not why we're here today to discuss Jocelyn Thompson's testimony. We're here to discuss the 63-420 and the lack of consistency of the instructions. And
Counsel, did you ask the district court to then give a cautionary instruction with regard to the other 63-420 witnesses?
No, because it was a strategic issue at that point to go back and to put more of an emphasis on what happened 40 years ago was not something I wanted to do. So I, quite frankly, the first couple of witnesses went, there was no instruction. We left it there. And then there was quite a bit of instruction for Jocelyn Thompson. It was a standard instruction. I'm not saying it was an improper instruction, but it was my belief that in order to maintain consistency, that we did not want that instruction to be read to the jury, because it would put an undue influence on Jocelyn Thompson's testimony.
And you made that known to the district court, and the district court provided it anyway?
Yes, there's a large record of that. I also want to talk about, and the 63-420 was used in addition to the cautionary instruction. The third point on that was that the state ended up using that is in his closing argument, and he called it a heck of a coincidence. So the state improperly used the 63-420 evidence as propensity that he committed this crime. Calling something a heck of a coincidence is a dog whistle for propensity. So to go back to the 63-420, the way it came in was unorganized, not clear. State got carte blanche to put in what they want. They were given the proverbial inch, and they took a mile as far as what they could get in. The instructions were inconsistent, and the state used the 63-420 evidence improperly, using it to call it a heck of a coincidence, which is indicative of a propensity to commit this offense.
Just so I'm clear. So there was a pretrial ruling about relationship evidence. Are you challenging that ruling, or are you simply accepting that ruling and challenging the way that the district court implemented it?
That's a good question. I did challenge the 63-420 evidence for the reasons articulated in the motion in limine. That's not necessarily in front of the court, because 63-420, I'm aware it's broad, and it allows the court some discretion. So my belief is my main challenge is we were given no guidance as to how it comes in. The court needs to find that the impact is substantially, or the prejudicial impact is not substantially outweighed by the probative evidence. The court never made those findings. In fact, we never talked about particular incidents. It just was general questions about how did he discipline you? Did he hit you with a horse crop? Did he do this? Did he do that? The prosecutor, in many leading questions, got in the evidence that he wanted to get in without any ruling from the court about what was acceptable and what was not. So to answer your question in a long-winded version, I apologize. What I'm saying is, yes, 63-420 evidence, not objecting to that, how it was used, yes.
And then, so my follow-up question is, did you during trial make objections or make requests for how it should be properly implemented?
I didn't as strategy, because my philosophy as an attorney who's tried quite a few cases, 63-420 evidence is very damaging to your client, because while juries are told not to use it as propensity evidence, they do. They think once, if you do something once, then you must be a bad person. You do it again. So I try to limit whatever the bigger objection that I make, and the bigger, more attention that I call out to it, the more of an impact it's going to be to a jury at that point. So when it comes in, I try to remain as low key as I possibly can, and hope that it gets over with quickly and we can move on to something else.
But weren't there opportunities for you to raise these procedural issues with the district judge in a sidebar or outside the presence of the jury in some way?
I suppose there would, but at that point, it'd be too late. The evidence was in at that time. I wasn't sure what kind of questions the prosecutor was going to ask. I wasn't sure the prosecutor was going to. We were given no guidance. That was the issue. We were given an order by the district court that said number 16, 17, 43, 21, those are approved without saying how they're approved and what findings I'm going to make and doing a balancing test. That was what I wasn't sure about at that time. Perhaps in hindsight, you could go back and we would seek clarification before a witness was ever seated, so we would know exactly what evidence was going to come in and what evidence wasn't, but we didn't get that, and I wasn't sure how it was going to be used. I did not imagine or anticipate the state was going to take as much liberty with the 63420 evidence as they did.
So, counsel, am I to understand your argument as one that the way the evidence was used shows that the district court abused its discretion because it was substantially more prejudicial than probative?
Yes, Your Honor. And those findings were never made. And that evidence came in. And like I said, it was, objections could have been made. I understand that. But it was done strategically to limit the impact of that evidence. The 63420 evidence was somewhat of a microcosm for what was used to my client, the character attacks that he had to endure throughout the entire trial. There were 40 years of parenting which evolved with society beliefs on discipline, but it also talked about his religious beliefs.
I see that your time for primary argument has expired. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for the state of Minnesota may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. I'll just address, I'm not going to regurgitate what's in my brief. There are a lot of issues here, so I'll just jump right in to address the issues that were raised by appellant in his oral argument. The first one he talked about was the prosecutorial misconduct of referring to RT as being honest. A couple of things that I just wanted to highlight. I've touched on most of these in my brief. The prosecutor never personalized it, never used a word I or me or anything like that. Just, it was a standard credibility argument. And as I note in the brief, the state is permitted to argue that a certain witness is or is not credible. Just as importantly, later on, the prosecutor specifically told the jury during closing argument that it's not my job to determine who's credible or not. That's your job. So the prosecutor accurately reflected the jury instructions that were made to the jury by the district court. And the jury was properly instructed by the district court on that. And even if there was some error, it would not have had a substantial impact on the jury's verdict. There was ample evidence that supported and bolstered RT's testimony. She told her older brother, KT, about the abuse back in 2013. She told her mother about the abuse, and her mother even got into that on her direct examination. That's in volume 3, pages 538 and 539. She concedes that that RT told her that her husband had touched RT's breasts. So that corroborates RT's credibility. And then, of course, the 634.20 evidence from the oldest sister, JT, amply corroborates it as well. So even if there was an error, it doesn't warrant a new trial. As far as the belittled, counsel argued that police agreed that the investigation was improper. I'm unaware of any agreement by any of the police officers. My recollection is that Investigator Tutlin specifically stated and agreed that this investigation was unique, but I'm unaware of any agreement by law enforcement, and I guess I would ask for a cite to the record where law enforcement agreed that the investigation was improper. I don't think there was any such agreement. I don't think Investigator Tutlin agreed that he had done anything wrong. And with respect to the 634.20 evidence, I cite Valentine and all the cases that talk about this, this evidence presumptively comes in unless it's substantially, the potential for prejudice substantially outweighs its probative value.
My concern, Mr. Magnuson, is that, underlying the notion that this is admissible evidence in proper situation is the fact that a jury is going to be instructed about the proper use of that evidence. We know that did not happen here. And I think what I heard from appellant's counsel is it not so much, the issue isn't so much whether the district court in the first instance abused its discretion by saying this type of evidence is going to come in, but how it was admitted and the inconsistencies and the failure to provide the guiding instruction to the jury. Can you respond to that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. There were two forms of 634.20 evidence. The evidence that RT and KT, the older brother, discussed and testified about was physical abuse. JT, the oldest sister, she also talked about the physical abuse, but that was a relatively small part of her testimony. The important part of her testimony was the consistent sexual abuse that she had had at the hands of appellant. So yes, with respect to the physical abuse that was testified to by RT and KT, there was no cautionary instruction prior to their testimony. There was, however, a cautionary instruction prior to JT's testimony, the oldest sister, and there was a general cautionary instruction as part of the district court's general charge to the jury. Even if the court were to find that there was some type of error with respect to the physical evidence, that's a relatively small portion of the state's case. And the biggest portion of the 634.20 evidence is JT's testimony that is, as the prosecutor referred to it, and this kind of goes into the propensity argument, referred to it as a heck of a coincidence that two women who have had no contact with each other, have had no ability to get their stories straight, tell remarkably similar stories. So as far as the 634.20 evidence with respect to JT, it does corroborate and corroborates RT's testimony and makes her testimony on that issue more credible. So the lion's share of the 634.20 evidence is the prior sexual abuse. There was a cautionary instruction provided before that testimony.
Mr. Magnuson, I'd like to turn to the issue about evidence of his religious beliefs. There's a rule of evidence that says such evidence may not be admitted for purposes of credibility. What was the purpose of the question to the witness about, it was a rather specific, perhaps leading question about whether he said that he was a prophet. What was the purpose of that question?
As argued by the prosecutor during closing, it helped, let me back up. The state, as part of its case in chief, had provided expert testimony with respect to why minor females or minors in general may delay reporting, among other things. She listed five reasons. I think number four was not wanting to go against authority figures. So as part of the closing argument, the state talked about how, yes, there had been a delay in reporting, but that the delay in reporting was understandable given the multiple roles that appellant filled in RT's life. And it wasn't just isolated. There were several roles that the appellant fulfilled, including a teacher, parent, religious guide. I think I'm forgetting something else, but it was a broader argument about why RT could nonetheless be credible, even though there was this long delay in reporting And as emphasized by the appellant read into the record those two letters that RT had submitted when she was going to community college in Cambridge about her love for her father. And even after the abuse had occurred, she had written these letters indicating that she loved her father. So that was a, it was an area that the prosecutor had to address, and the prosecutor addressed it. The references to religious guide with respect to RT were isolated, and overall, referring to appellant as a religious guide as part of other roles that he fulfilled with respect to RT, I don't think was error.
It seems that the state could have put in evidence in a different way that he was a religious guide to his daughter. But the statement that he's a prophet, it seems likely that jurors might disbelieve that and therefore might use the evidence to for purposes of assessing his credibility. Don't you think so?
If I would have tried it, I don't know that I would have used the word prophet. But it's far different from prophet than, as appellant argues, zealot, religious zealot. I don't think there is any incendiary language that was used here. And even if there was, it was such a small part of the record here. It was religious prophet. That word was not, the word prophet was not used in the state's closing argument. It was just the phrase religious guide. So I don't think the phrase religious guide is objectionable. And based on the isolated phrase religious prophet out of a jury trial that went on for 3 days of testimony, lots of witnesses, I don't see that that was had a substantial impact on the jury's verdicts. Overall, with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, I touched on it briefly. Yes, there's inconsistencies with RT's testimony. Yes, there was delayed reporting. All of these issues were raised and argued by the appellant below, but there was a substantial amount of corroboration, and it's unacknowledged by the appellant. Appellant or RT testified that she had told her other older brother KT in 2013 about the abuse, and KT on direct examination agreed with that. RT testified that she told her mother about the abuse, and her mother also agreed with that. And again, this is on 538, line 22. Yes, she had called me and she had said, you know, mom, dad, I want you to know dad abused me. He touched my breasts. That's consistent with RT's testimony. And then lastly, the 634.20 testimony from JT, the older sister, corroborated the or I should say bolstered her credibility. So overall, there is ample evidence that supported the jury's verdicts, and that evidence was strong enough that I don't think there's a reasonable basis to believe that any of these errors, should there have been any error, I don't believe there was a reasonable basis that it significantly impacted the jury's verdicts. So I'd ask the court to affirm on all these issues. Thank you.
I have a very general question, Mr. Magnuson, and that is, I'm unclear as to whether appellant's wife testified, and if so, who called her, and what her testimony was in general.
Yes, Wendy Thompson was called by the defense, and she testified in volume 3. The portions that I was quoting from are on page 538 to 539. And she testified, I'd be speculating if I went back and tried to guess as to everything that she testified to. I've looked at a couple of the portions of her testimony that support my argument, but I'd be hesitant to try and fill in the blanks. But she did testify and she was called by the defense.
We're ready for rebuttal argument from appellant's counsel.
Okay. Well, the first thing I want to say is that her telling other people that this occurred is not corroboration. No one believed her. Her brother indicated that Kim Paul Thompson didn't really do anything when he heard that this had happened. If he believed her, he would have taken some proactive action. Her mother said that she did not believe her. That was a big part of the trial as to whether or not her mother was a mandated reporter, and to whether or not her mother would have had to report these allegations, but her mother believed that they were a liar. She was a liar because that was her reputation, and that's how she was as a child. And the attorney for the respondent indicated that as far as the 63420 evidence goes, that it was a heck of a coincidence because JT and RT never spoke. However, on page 352 of the transcript, it was brought out in cross-examination that Jocelyn Thompson or JT had said that RT reminded me of something I told the former investigator when I reported it. So there was collusion. There was the only corroboration in this case was that RT told JT something that she said back when she made allegations all the way back in 2001. So somehow RT had access to the police records back then, looked at it, and then told JT what to say. RT's role in this investigation was, quite frankly, something I've never seen before. She went to the house for the arrest. Yes.
Counsel, I know they were unusual and it was the subject of much direct and cross-examination at trial. But I guess my question is, I mean, these arguments were all presented to the jury, right?
They were. And they were. That's the sufficiency of evidence. Yep.
Right. And you cite like I think the Huss case and some other case law that involves, you know, three-year-old witnesses and things like that. I mean, this is not a case where RT, the complainant, was an incompetent witness, right?
No, but it's the sensationalism of the case. I think juries get emotional about cases like this with families. And I think what a jury, when a court of appeals, a reviewing court needs to look at is they need to look at whether or not juries are not experts because they sit on a panel for 3 days. They're not an expert on cooperation. They're not an expert on sufficiency evidence. Yes.
Judge Larkin here, you keep mentioning corroboration, whether or not the jury was jurors were experts on corroboration, but the case law does not require corroboration for an allegation of criminal sexual conduct, correct?
It doesn't, but if a single witness is deemed to be credible by a jury, and the prosecutor, this is where all the mistakes and the errors all add up. This is where the character assassinations about his employment status, that was prominent through the thing, religion. I'm glad the court brought that up because that particular question about the prophet, if the court reads back that transcript, the state practically did a backflip to get that evidence into in front of the jury. He referred to her as a religious guide, or him as a religious guide, probably about 15 times in his opening and closing statement. The religion was, again, a dog whistle for the fact that this guy was a cult-like leader. That was the underlying subtitles of this case. This was an unemployed person who lived off of his successful wife, who beat his kids, who is a serial religious zealot. And that was the way that he was portrayed in this particular case. So when you talk about a case like this with the credibility and the corroboration and all these things that a jury could look at, when you talk about some of those cases that I cited, yes, she wasn't a three-year-old, but all of these errors taken together cumulatively, especially with the 63420, the religion, the character attacks, the propensity, all these cumulative errors add up to the fact that Mr. Thompson wasn't given a fair trial. The religion was a microcosm for the state's case in this, that he could do this because he was a cult-like persona. That's the way it came off in person when I was there. And the question about the prophet underscored that, because why else would you want to get what relevance did that have to the case about whether or not someone committed criminal sexual conduct? The judge had said in the motion in limine that religion would provide some context for the charges.
But yeah. Counsel, doesn't it provide context in the sense that it explains the delay of reporting and may also explain why everybody in the family lined up to call RT a liar? I mean, isn't it? And whether it was overplayed or not, I guess I'm would have to go back and look more specifically at the questions, but I certainly have concerns about the reference to, or the question about the prophet status. But I mean, the fact that he serves as the religious leader of the household and maybe a religious guide for other people, I mean, that does provide some context for the jury to evaluate, you know, the delay in reporting and why none of the family believed RT, doesn't it?
I suppose that that could be an argument that made, but it wasn't. Argument wasn't presented in front of the court. It was just religion was brought up just to talk about religion. Religion was used pejoratively without explaining it. It just was left to kind of sit there without explaining what it meant or what the context was. The expert witness talked about by the attorney for the respondent never spoke about how religious families, these allegations are harder to report, or how like in cults that the little kids are abused and that's just part of it and the older kids cover it up. There was no context about the religion. It was just kind of brought there, used pejoratively, used to essentially character assassinate my client, as was his socioeconomic status, his employment status, his abusing of the kids, and the fact that he, and again, the religion was used most prominently. Again, I point the court back to the exchange between myself, the prosecutor, and the judge, and the witness when the prosecutor was trying to get in the evidence that this person was a religious prophet. That was counsel, never disclosed in the discovery. Yes.
Counsel, I think you've made your point. You've summarized the heart of your argument at this point, and you are out of time. So I'm going to stop you there.
That's fine.
We appreciate the arguments and the briefings. The case is submitted, and you will have our decision within the 90 days required by law. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.